Podcast, one of the many great podcasts you'll find on the Pitcherless Podcast Network. I'm Pete Ball, your host today, normally joined by Chad Young, but as you know, at least our dedicated listeners would have noticed by now, we haven't had an episode in quite a few weeks, I don't know, like 3 or 4 weeks now. I wish it was for some exciting reason. It's just more Chad and I have had very busy summers. We're having a hard time linking up, particularly on the weekends, which is when we record most of the time. So here for episode, I think 174, that sounds about right. I will not be with Chad. I'm going to fly a little solo today. I want to look at a few things. First of all, we're going to do the head-to-head hero of the week. I'll get into who that is in just a second. We're going to talk about the MLB trade deadline. Now, I'm willing to bet if you listen to this podcast, you listen to a lot of fantasy baseball podcasts, and all of them have already talked about the MLB trade deadline, but we on Keeper Cut, as usual, are going to talk about them from a Keeper League perspective, which oftentimes will carry over to Otnew as well, which is an interesting form of a Keeper League where it's more cost association than dollar values, I should say, as opposed to round values on Otnew. But the same sort of information should translate to both your Keeper Leagues and Otnew Leagues and Dynasty Leagues as well. We're going to look at some of the players whose values may have changed in one direction or another. It's sort of like the domino effect of the trades at the trade deadline when we get to that. And time permitting, at the end, I want to look at some players who, in my mind, the last month and few weeks here, we got plenty of weeks left here in August, about 3 or 4 weeks left in August, and then the whole month of September. Who are the players who I'm looking at and thinking, like, man, their keeper value could change dramatically in one direction or another? Obviously, any players could if there was an injury. But I'm talking like guys like right now, you're probably still on the fence about whether or not to keep them at cost. And yet we have only 2 months left. So what's left on the schedule is really going to dictate how you feel about some of these players going forward, or at least how I feel about them. Maybe I say these names and you're like, man, I love those guys. I'm totally keeping them regardless of what they do over the last 2 months. In which case, that's fine. But there's a few names that certainly have my attention or have more of my attention coming down the stretch here. So episode 174 is being recorded here on Friday, August 8th. That's before Friday's games. It will not be posted until Monday, August 11th. So just keep that in mind. If I say something here and you're like, why are we talking about this player? He, you know, got hurt or whatever over the weekend. It's because I'm recording on Friday. I can't imagine that would impact a lot of what I have to say here. One weekend of baseball isn't going to really change a lot of things in keeper leagues unless, you know, unfortunately there is an injury. So let's just hope that's not the case. And let's get into it here with the head-to-head hero of the week. So this one was pretty obvious to me, honestly. As you know, with these, we usually like to choose guys that are not Aaron Judge or Shohei Ohtani, right? We want to choose guys who are like maybe on the fringes, maybe even free agents in some of your leagues if they're a little bit more shallower leagues in this case. And so I went with Shea Longoliers, who like even if we could choose Schwarber, Ohtani, Judge, whatever, I still think Shea Longoliers was probably the head-to-head hero of the week in all your leagues. He went 13 for 27 over the last 7 days. That's a 481 average, 6 runs, 4 homers, 6 RBI. And Longoliers is really trudging along here. There was a lot of hype going on in him going into the season, and honestly, I think he's kind of lived up to it. He's on pace, you know, obviously to finish with a barrel percentage north of 11% for the third straight season. It's right there at 11.1%. He set a new career high max exit velocity at 114.5 miles an hour this season. Not this week. I don't know if that hit came this week. I don't want that to be confusing. Head-to-head hero of the week, and I'm citing season-long numbers here. But the big breakthrough for Shea Longoliers this season is his strikeout rate. I mean, he's doing something completely different at the plate because he was at a 27.2% strikeout rate last season, which is not good. I mean, that's like, that's borderline, like, droppable. That's, you're going to have a bad batting average. That's like, you better make up with that or for that with elite barrel rates, exit velocities, all that stuff. He's down to 18.3% strikeout rate this year. That is a huge leap for his game at the plate. 18.3%, man, that's like, that's going from a terrible strikeout rate of 27.2 to like an actually really, really good strikeout rate at 18.3%. So I don't think that could be understated. That 27.2% strikeout rate he had last year was already a career best because the first 2 years of his career, his strikeout rate was horrible. This year, 18.3, I mean, clearly seeing the ball a little bit better at the plate. He's swinging more. He's just whiffing a lot less. He's down from a 29.2% whiff rate last year to 23% this year. He's chasing marginally less, but he's making a lot more contact when he does chase, which, you know, you could argue if that's not exactly what you want, and I would listen to that. You don't want to make a lot of contact outside of the zone. Very rarely is that going to be beneficial contact. If there's not two strikes, you might be better off just swinging and missing outside of the zone. But his zone contact rate is also up a lot from 80.3% last year, which is just a little below league average. Like, that's not really like a big deal, 80.3%. But now he's at 85.1%, so he's up about 5 percentage points. That's noticeably above the league average. So progress. It's beginning to make sense why that strikeout rate is all the way down at 18.3%. He's kind of like gotten better each month, which is exciting here. In April, he had a 766 OPS, which isn't great. In May, it did get worse, so I shouldn't say he got better every month. In May, he had a 697 OPS. And so there may be a lot of leagues where he was dropped at that point. You know, people were catchers deep this year, it feels like. And if Longoliers wasn't hitting and you're ready to move on to the next catcher, maybe he got cut. But since then, June, 806 OPS. All right, now we're north of 800. We're talking July, 951 OPS in the month of July. And so far here in August, which is no surprise, you know, he gets the player of the week on August 8th. Probably means he has a pretty crazy August OPS so far. And he does. It's at 1501. So, you know, it's like a Barry Bonds-esque OPS. So we're, you know, 8 days here, whatever, 7 days. It goes to show that he's improving as the season has gone on, though. Recently, you know, manager Mark Kotze moved Longoliers to the leadoff spot. He spent most of the season batting cleanup in the leadoff spot. His numbers are incredible. It's a three-game sample, whatever, but 7-for-14 with 4 runs, 3 homers, 4 RBI. He's only struck out twice over that time period. Most of that damage did come in one game, but he's hit in all three coming from that leadoff spot. And he's fourth on the ESPN player rater at catcher. He's only behind Cal Raleigh, Hunter Goodman, and Will Smith. All three of those guys in the player rater are pretty substantially ahead of him, but he's top five at the position. He's fourth at the position. That obviously puts him ahead of some great names, both Contreras's, although obviously, you know, William is not having that great of a season. Agustin Ramirez, who's been great. Salvador Perez, Ivan Herrera, who I know has battled injury, but is still having a really good season at the position. And Shea Longoliers is ahead of all of them. With that said, you know, I kind of dug into the numbers a little bit. How am I going to be looking at Shea Longoliers during draft season next year? He doesn't crack the top five at the position in barrels per plate appearance percentage, hard hit percentage, EV50, which is basically the average exit velocity of the hardest 50% of a player's batted balls. You know, he ranks ninth in that category, and that's like a spot where I would kind of expect him to be higher in at catcher. Hard hit percentage, 15th among qualifiers, and that barrels per plate appearance percentage, he's 7th. So not like terrible, but he's not that big of a standout at the position, despite this recent hot streak and all the things I've said before. And I think that's more a testament to how deep catcher's been. But Longoliers had an ADP of 111.23 across NFBC this season. Keep in mind, most of their leagues, if not all of them, are two catcher, so that would, you know, push that a little bit closer, or a little higher, I guess I should say. Putting his keeper value in a lot of leagues, I don't know, probably around like the 9th or 10th round in most leagues, or higher if your league had a lot of inflation, assuming he wasn't, you know, kept at a cheaper price. And given that cost and the fact that he doesn't stand out too much at the position, even after this hot streak, I'm not sure I'm willing to keep him at such a price just yet. So maybe he does kind of fit into that category of players I'm going to talk about at the end of the show of like guys I really want to see over the last 2 months. You know, with that said, let's see. Because right now it's hard to argue with the results. He seems to be getting better every month. He's got that leadoff spot in the lineup. Let's see if Longoliers kind of plays himself into keeper position. But at the very least, he is our episode 174 head-to-head hero of the week. All right, so let's talk some trade deadline here. First of all, as a Red Sox fan, the trade deadline was a little bit disappointing. You know, it didn't really feel like other teams were doing all that much. I know the Yankees really stocked up their bullpen, and, you know, that, well, we're going to talk about that, but I don't know how much of a success that has really been. The Rangers ended up getting Merrill Kelly, who I thought was a good fit for the Red Sox. And they did end up trading for Dustin May, which felt like, I don't know, not that great. And Dustin May, he looked good in his first two innings with the Sox, and then it kind of all fell apart in the third, if I recall correctly. I don't have a lot of expectations for Dustin May. The velocity's gone, and he just doesn't seem like himself. Good luck to him going forward. Maybe he just needs a little bit of a reset here after all the injuries he's dealt with and come home or come back strong next year. But Sox didn't really do that many of exciting things. So I got to get my homer stuff out of the way. I'm excited about the Red Sox. They're playing great baseball. But, man, it would have been nice if they were the ones who got Shane Bieber or they were the ones who got Merrill Kelly. I would have felt a lot better going forward with the Sox. And, hey, Chad's Guardians, I don't know what's going on there, man. Everybody in the bullpen is gambling. Best closer in baseball is probably about to get, like, banned for life or something. They traded away Shane Bieber but kept Stephen Kwan when it feels like they could have got a King's ransom for Stephen Kwan. I don't know. I'm sure Chad will have all sorts of things to say about Cleveland when he's back for episode 175, but it wasn't the best trade deadline, I'd say, for the fellas of Keeper Cut here. For fantasy baseball, though, it also really wasn't the best trade deadline. I just don't think a lot of really significant things happen that we need to, like, feel passionately different about when it comes to, like, players' individual values. Obviously, a lot of guys on rentals got traded, which means, like, for keeper leagues and long-term leagues, it's not that big of a deal. Like, Eugenio Suarez goes to Seattle. He's a free agent at the end of the year. Josh Naylor goes to Seattle, steals, you know, 10 bags in 11 games or whatever it is. He looks unbelievable, but he's also probably going to be playing for somebody new next year. So I don't know if there's a lot to chew on there when it comes to these bats. But with that said, and I do apologize, I see my volume is doing all sorts of stuff here. Hopefully it comes out okay. But with that said, there's still fantasy implications, even keeper league implications as a result of this trade deadline. The majority of pieces that felt like they were moving, or at least the majority of, like, major pieces that moved, were bullpen pieces, which, you know, as Chad and I will tell you, like, in keeper leagues, not really that big of a deal. But if you can get an elite closer on, like, a last round contract because he was dropped or whatever, that's when things begin to change. So let's look at a few of the bullpen situations across MLB as a result of the trade deadline, or bullpen situations that changed as a result of the trade deadline. One to monitor if you're out of contention in your keeper leagues is the Ryan Helsley situation. Now, Ryan Helsley has not pitched particularly well this year. The whip is really high, but he's an unrestricted free agent at the end of the season. And so odds are that Ryan Helsley is going to end up with a closer's role by the time the spring rolls around, assuming, you know, he doesn't flop here with the Mets in his eighth inning role in front of Edwin Diaz. If he's really good, teams are going to view him as a closer. He's probably going to sign a decent contract to be a closer for a team next year. And I mean, Ryan Helsley was going, I don't even know, I'd have to look it up, but I imagine his ADP was pretty high, pretty expensive. And that was on a team like the Cardinals going into the season. Most people expected they weren't going to be very good. If Helsley ends up signing with, I was just talking about them, so I'll just throw it out there. Let's say he signs with the Red Sox. The Red Sox let Chapman walk. They bring in Ryan Helsley as their closer. He's probably going to be going at a similarly expensive price again. So if you could add him because someone else dropped him, and as a result, adding him off of free agency makes him really discounted according to your league's keeper rules, he's worth keeping an eye on. You know, if you're only keeping three or four, you probably don't want to keep a closer. You definitely don't want to keep someone that's not a closer or a reliever that's not a closer. But even if they are a closer, you probably don't want to keep them. If you're playing in like the keeper cut listener leagues, the head-to-head, I've kept Andrés Muñoz for like 3 years now because his price is still in like the 21st round or something like that. That's a huge steal to get one of the five best closers in the game at that price. And it's just because I added him when he was a reliever. That made his keeper price essentially free, and now I get to keep him essentially forever as long as he has that role at a discounted price. So don't completely rule it out if you're in those deeper keeper leagues. Ryan Helsley could be somebody to target if you have sold or if it's looking like, you know, your keeper situation is a little iffy. Keep an eye on Helsley. The Yankees bullpen. I mentioned we were going to talk about them. Devin Williams is, like Ryan Helsley, going to be an unrestricted free agent. He's a mercenary at this point for the Yankees this year, and not a very good one. He's a terrible mercenary. He's a mercenary with an ERA over 5 that I wouldn't be surprised if at this moment in time he's lost the closer's role. Now, nothing official has been said. Remember, I'm recording on Friday, August 8th, so, you know, if Devin Williams throws 3 innings with 0 hits, 0 walks, and 9 strikeouts this weekend, please forgive me. And we all know he's capable of that. I think the tools are hopefully still there. He's just having a miserable season. But if he has, in fact, lost the job, I would consider David Bednar. The Yankees acquired David Bednar at the trade deadline. He was having an amazing season for Pittsburgh. He recorded a 5-out save 2 days ago. He had a clean 1-inning hold the day before that. I wouldn't be surprised if he leapfrogs Luke Weaver in the pecking order. I mean, I guess there's no reason to believe that Weaver was even ahead of him to begin with, but obviously going into the trade deadline, Luke Weaver was the Yankees' 8th-inning guy, and Weaver has pitched better recently. He was also struggling for a little bit of time there. But I wouldn't be surprised if Bednar leapfrogs him and snatches the role from Williams. Camilo Duvall just pitched like the 6th inning the other day. He's not going to be the closer, I don't think. And Bednar, you know, unlike Williams, is not a free agent at the end of the year. So if someone dropped Bednar in one of your leagues, I'd consider adding him. He'd be a potentially elite keeper situation. If you could add the Yankees closer for 2026 on a last round pick because he was a free agent, that's pretty good. I mean, Bednar's got a 32.4% CSW. It's the highest of his career. His 12.54 strikeouts per nine, his 2.16 FIP, his 2.63 XFIP. These are all career bests for a guy who's been an all-star. This could be a top five closer. And he's someone who is at least going to be under contract for next season with the Yankees. So Bednar is somebody who the trade deadline may have really changed his value. I mean, it ruined it at first, his value for at least this season. But if he takes this role from Devin Williams and keeps it for next season and somebody else dropped him because they saw, Bednar no longer closing for the Pirates and now he's going to that Yankees bullpen. Now he's going to be a 7th-inning guy or an 8th-inning guy. Oh, I would go and scoop him because there is a lot of upside there for David Bednar going into next season. I mean, honestly, even Bednar, I was to look up his ADP on NFBC, which, you know, sometimes if you just look at general NFBC, like all of their different leagues for baseball, sometimes closers will be a little bit more expensive because there's a lot of draft and holds and things like that. But Bednar, yeah, an ADP of essentially 190. So even if he didn't get dropped and you just have him and you haven't dropped him yet, I'd consider holding on because I'd probably pay that price to have the Yankees closer for next year. So that's a situation worth keeping an eye on that nothing's been official yet, but a decision may have already been made. I would not be surprised. Devin Williams really has been that bad. With that said, let's take our first break. And when we come back, we will talk about some other trades from the trade deadline. A bat that moved, honestly, it's crazy to say this, but I think the most significant bat, keeper league-wise, to move at the trade deadline. I really hope I'm not forgetting anyone. It's hard not having a co-host right now to, like, fact-check me on this, but Carlos Correa might be the most interesting non-reliever, at least when it comes to the impact it's going to make in keeper leagues. He moved from Minnesota to Houston. Minnesota basically paying $30 million to get rid of him. He's made 5 starts at third base, so he should have third base now or very soon across all formats. He'll retain shortstop eligibility for next year as well, giving you some decent flexibility if you have him and ends up being a keeper for you. He's already homered with Houston. He's hitting .346. He's got a .931 OPS. It kind of feels like, man, like things could be really looking up here for Carlos Correa. It's a very small sample. It's like a week's worth of numbers. You know, if we go by a week's worth of numbers, we should give Shea Longoliers the MVP. I get that, but it's showing signs of life for a player that nothing seemed to look good for Carlos Correa. He got out of Minnesota. He's back home in Houston, and it looks like he's chefing something up. It's hard to believe, but Correa is still just 30 years old. That's not like a young player necessarily, but that's not an old player. He could have some pretty solid fantasy seasons left in him. His average exit velocity is also really good at 91.1 miles an hour. I don't know, when you start to put the pieces together here, you can see how Correa could be a decently valuable piece now that he's back in Houston. If he finishes the season on a really high note, and you can keep him essentially for free, he was somebody who was not expensive in drafts, and honestly, between draft day and now, he was probably added and dropped in all of your leagues a decent amount of times. Even if he wasn't, if somebody's been sticking it out with Kareem all this time because it's a deep league or whatever, his ADP was 231. You could keep him at that price, assuming he continues to stay hot here in Houston. So I don't know. I'm looking at that and thinking maybe Carlos Correa is worth keeping. Maybe he is. We'll see. We got a lot of time to decide this, but at the very least, I think we can all agree his value has improved since 2 weeks ago when he was still a Minnesota Twin. We did have a prospect move. A lot of prospects moved, but the most significant prospect to move was Leo DeVries. I hope I'm saying that correctly. It's either Leo DeVries or Leo DeVries. I'm going to go with DeVries and hope that is correct. My apologies if it's not. He's a top three prospect in all of baseball, courtesy of MLB Pipeline, and in most major prospect lists. You'll find him close to the top, at least top five. Everyone knows he was moved for Mason Miller and JP Sears, which I think caught some people by surprise. I don't think there's anything actionable here, though. Like, obviously in long-term leagues, if a top three prospect moves, that's going to, like, you know, raise the alarm bells and maybe get your ears to perk up a little bit. But, like, this dude's 18 years old. I don't think he's particularly close to the major leagues. And even if he is, well, I don't think him being in San Diego or him being in Oakland is really going to change anything. If he lives up to the hype, he's going to be very good. If he doesn't, you know, cut him and move on. But at this point in time, I don't think as a result of this trade, there's anything you need to do with DeVries. I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise that San Diego, with AJ Preller at the helm, got rid of him. I don't think he, at the moment, gains or loses any value with the move to the Athletics. Mason Miller, though, this one's interesting. I think for people it's frustrating. For the rest of the season, his value might plummet. He was already having a weak season ERA-wise. A 3.92 ERA is just not good for a reliever, especially a closer. And although his strikeouts, save total, and whip were all looking really great, honestly, he now finds himself in, like, at best a share of the closing duties, more likely an eighth inning job as Robert Suarez continues to pitch well in the closer role for San Diego. However, the book is not closed on Miller. If Miller gets dropped in your league as a result of not getting any saves, right? Like, it sounds crazy dropping Mason Miller, but if he's not in the closer's role and your league is not a saves holds league, your league is not a strikeouts per nine league, like, Mason Miller's pretty droppable. He might be worth pouncing on. Similar to Ryan Helsley, more so than Ryan Helsley, I would argue. Suarez has an opt-out in his contract for after the season, 2 years, $16 million remaining. That's $8 million per. That's not $16 million per. $60 million total over 2 years. He's 35 years old, and he's having a great season. This might be his last chance to sign, like, a substantial contract, at least by reliever standards. So if he does opt out, obviously Miller is the likely guy to take over that closer role. The only situation in which that maybe wouldn't be the case is if they decide to try him out as a starter. Manny Randhawa of MLB, he was citing a report from The Athletic. This was before the trade deadline. He suggested that the reason why the Padres might part with elite prospects such as DeVries, kind of, you know, Nostradamus over here, because that ended up being, you know, the two major pieces of that trade, is that AJ Preller might try to convert Miller back into a starter, as the organization already did successfully with Stephen Kulick and Seth Lugo. He also mentioned Michael King, but if you remember, the Yankees converted Michael King to a starter, and then Michael King looked great as a starter, and he got traded to the Padres for Juan Soto, where he continued to be a starter and be really effective. So I have a hard time giving the Padres credit for that, but they did, you know, inherit a guy who was a reliever, at least for parts of seasons before, and he had his first year as a starter beginning to end with the Padres in Michael King. So it makes sense that they would maybe try to do that with Mason Miller. I know what my co-host would say. Chad wouldn't like this, and I wouldn't blame him. Miller's career high in innings pitch for a season is 92.2 innings pitch. You have to go all the way back to 2021 when he was in college to find that number. His body has not held up as a starter. It just hasn't, and that shouldn't be surprising. His average fastball velocity is 101.2 miles an hour. Even if the Padres can teach him to take a little bit off his fastball to allow him to stretch out to a starter's role, like, who's to say if he'll still be as effective? I mean, he's struggled at times this season, even as a closer, averaging 101 miles an hour. So I wouldn't automatically assume he'd be successful as a starter, especially if he has to take a little bit off the velocity to go deeper into outings. regardless, this is certainly a conversation that San Diego is having behind closed doors. And if Miller's actually dropped, or if you can acquire a cheap Mason Miller because their manager doesn't want to deal with a middle reliever, I think he could provide value next season, either as San Diego's closer, or it would at least be interesting to see him in a starter's role. But certainly as a closer on a last round pick, Mason Miller is one of the best in the big leagues, regardless of his ERA that's hovering around four. All the other data would suggest he's awesome. So if you can get him on a last round pick because of this trade deadline, I think it's worth doing. Other than that, guys, honestly, I don't think the trade deadline had a lot of big keeper implications. It kind of feels like, maybe I'm just being like a crabby old man here, it feels like every year people claim it was like the greatest trade deadline ever. And it's just like, really? That was the greatest trade deadline ever? At least from a fantasy perspective, not big changes here. Moving on to the next part of the show, the last part of the show on this solo episode, I wanted to look at some players that, and we'll see how much time we have permitting them, looking at like a 45-minute episode here, so I'll try to fit in as many of these guys as I can. But players who, as the season closes out, I think their keeper value can really fluctuate in one direction or another. We're going to ignore players who went in the first few rounds of drafts, as they are rarely worth keeping anyway. I maybe shouldn't say rarely, but there's not a lot. If you took a guy in the first three rounds and you're going to keep him, there's not a lot that's going to happen in the next 2 months that's going to change that. We're also going to ignore players who went undrafted in most leagues, because even if they kind of fall off in the last 2 months, they're still kind of probably worth keeping because they're free to keep. They're a last round pick in most situations. So obviously in both of those instances, there isn't much fluctuation of their value to occur. So the first player I wanted to talk about here is Gavin Williams. Gavin Williams, starting pitcher for the Cleveland Guardians. He is in his third year. He's enjoying a pretty good season on the surface. I mean, you're 5x5 categories. He's looking pretty good. He's made 23 starts, so this is already by far the most starts he's made in his career in a season. He's 7-4. The strikeouts per nine, a little bit undesirable at 8.86, but he does have a 3.17 ERA after this recent hot streak that he's been on. So Gavin Williams has been looking pretty good. The problem is he's still walking a lot of people, which has inflated his whip to a 1.30 whip this season, 1.37 last year. Those aren't good. Those are not useful. Those are going to hurt you, actively hurt you in your leagues. And so we want to see the strikeouts begin to tick up for Gavin Williams. We want to see the walks go down. And we really haven't seen that despite this hot streak that he's been on. However, because he's been so hot lately, because he was once a top prospect, because he is still young, Gavin Williams, I think, is 26 years old. Yeah, 26 years old. He won't turn 27 until next July. You know, there's still a lot to like here. First round pick. He was a 23rd overall pick back in 2021. So Gavin Williams, let's start breaking things down. Like I said, former top prospect, debuted in 2023, found some success then, underwhelming strikeout numbers. ERA estimators all suggested that he was a little bit lucky. He was putrid last season, and for parts of this year, he has been pretty bad as well, especially when it comes to the walks. However, since July 2nd, I mentioned his hot streak, and we're skewing the numbers. We're ignoring July 1st because he went against the hard-hitting Cubs and didn't have that great of an outing. But since July 2nd, Williams is 2-0 over six starts. He struck out 41 over 38 and two-thirds innings pitched, and he's posted a 1.63 ERA. Those are elite numbers. It's over a strikeout per inning. That ERA is obviously crazy good at 1.63. So whenever a guy this young with this much promise starts to do things like that over almost 2 months now, you begin to take notice. He almost threw a no-hitter the other night. Problem is the ERA estimators, they all have him about two full runs higher. He's got a 3.65 FIP, a 3.67 XFIP. The walk rate still leaves a lot to be desired. He has a 3.96 walks per nine over the stretch, an 11.8 walk percentage. Again, this is all just over the stretch that he's been on, these six starts. His strand rate is a ridiculous 95.4%, and his BABIP against is 170, both suggesting a lot of luck over these six starts. And finally, the quality of the opponent also has been pretty bad. I mean, I don't like to put too much stock into a pitcher's schedule. I don't think it's fair. And this one really isn't that bad. He had two really strong starts in there against the Tigers and the Mets. Both of those teams are very good. I will say over the same time period, again, we're looking at July 2nd until today, the Tigers and Mets both rank in the bottom third of MLB and WRC+. So although they look like they were difficult opponents, maybe they actually weren't as difficult as we might think. The other four starts, I mentioned there were six starts over this time period, one against the Tigers, one against the Mets. The other four came against the Twins, the Royals, the Athletics, and the White Sox. So combine all of this, right? This is a guy who has not had a lot of major league success so far. He's still walking the yard. He is way underperforming his FIP and XFIP, excuse me. His strand rate is ridiculous at 95.5%. The BABIP is super low against. It really does seem like this stretch has been a lot of luck. That's a lot to untangle, right? On one hand, you got a young pitcher with excellent extension, top prospect, one of the best fastballs in the league. I mean, by stuff plus, his fastball is better than Joe Ryan's. It's better than Robbie Ray's. It's better than Carlos Rodon's. He's on fire right now. He was within an out or two of a no-hitter. One of the best hitters in the league had to break it up in Juan Soto. But on the other hand, I mean, it's a pitcher who still has serious walk issues, yet to find sustained success at the big league level, and seems to have had some serious luck over the last few weeks. So in my eyes, this is a guy absolutely worth watching over the next month and a half. I could see him becoming a slam dunk keeper, even at draft costs. So he might have been dropped earlier in the year when he was pitching really poorly and the walk rate was terrible, because teams only invested, I mean, he had an ADP of 216. So he may have been dropped in a lot of leagues. Even if you held on to him at an ADP of 216, I could see over the next month and a half, if he continues to deliver, maybe cuts down on the walks a little bit, like, he's probably worth keeping at that price. I could also see him disappointing over the next month and a half, as he has done throughout his career so far, and not being worth keeping, even at that price. You just don't want to use a keeper slot on him. If he pitches every five games for the rest of the season, his schedule is going to look like, well, he's got Miami next Wednesday. Then he would be at Arizona, at Texas, versus Seattle, at Tampa Bay, versus Kansas City, versus the White Sox, at Detroit, and then versus the Rangers again at the end of the year. That's assuming, obviously, he makes a start every 5 days, which he might not. They might mix things up, go with a six-man some week. You know, somebody needs a break, whatever. I don't know. It's a rough estimate of what his schedule is going to look like. That's doable. There's a few tests in there that we'll want to see, right? He's going to be at Detroit. He's going to get Texas a couple of times. These are good baseball teams. He's going to get Seattle. They're hot. Hopefully, by going through these tests and increasing the difficulty of the schedule and stretching out the sample size, we get to get more of an indicator of, like, has it been luck, or is Gavin Williams begin to turn a page? But there's going to be a lot of decisions the manager's going to have with Gavin Williams, and I really think the next month and a half is going to ultimately decide what those decisions end up being. With that said, we have enough time for at least one more guy. Before we get into him, though, we're going to take one more break, and we'll be right back. All right, everyone, welcome back. Keeper Cut, episode 174. It's Pete Ball without Chad Young. We did the head-to-head hero of the week. It was Shea Longoliers. We talked about the trade deadline and the implications for some of the players there, mostly relievers, but a little bit of Carlos Correa as well. We're now breaking down players who I think in keeper leagues you need to keep a close eye on over the last 6, 7, 8 weeks, whatever it is, of the rest of the season. We just spent some time talking about Gavin Williams, who's had a lot of success lately, but maybe with a little bit lucky. And now I want to talk about the second baseman slash outfielder for the Red Sox, Seydon Rafaela. I think it should be noted right off the bat, Rafaela might just be a keeper for most people. He was probably dropped in a lot of leagues before he became Superman for a stretch of time in June and barely looked back. In which case, if you added him, he's now worth a last round pick, which I said we wouldn't talk about those guys. However, he did have an ADP of 1 second. Rafaela was being drafted around pick 183. So if you have him at that cost, it might be a little bit more of a conversation depending on what he does over the next week and a half. He provides speed, some pop. He should have both outfield and second base eligibility for 2026. When the Sox are healthy, though, Rafaela consistently hits in the bottom half of the order, often the bottom third. that's going to limit his counting number upside. Although where you bat in the order, I guess, like at this moment anyway, shouldn't necessarily impact your keeper value going forward. He doesn't really profile as a player who will hit in the top third. He chases a ton. His walk rate is just 4.2%. That's in the bottom fourth percentile of the league. So when you consider it's a market like Boston, they have all these young players coming up, and Rafael is right there with them. He just doesn't really profile as somebody who's going to hit in that top third of the lineup. So that's obviously working against him. But according to Sox beat writer Tim Healy of The Globe, the Sox told Rafael to pull the ball in the air more during their series in Milwaukee back at the end of May. What followed were line drive rates that were significant jumps from his 10.1% line drive rate he had in May. Now, it should be noted, I mean, his line drive rate has fluctuated all over the place. And I also want to note that these numbers are from Fangraphs, and they clearly calculate line drive rate differently than how StatCast does. So you might hear these numbers and be like, these are super low across the board. His line drive rate sucks. But that's because they just look higher on StatCast. Again, I don't exactly know what the difference is in how they calculate them. But on Fangraphs, in May, he had a 19.7%, in May, he had a 10.1% line drive rate. That Milwaukee series was at the end of the month. And then in June, he essentially doubled his line drive rate to 19.7%. Then it was 16% in July. And so far in August, it's at 18.8%. That is a small sample, right? It's just a few months, but it's a tangible thing that we can sink our teeth into, right? Like, according to a beat reporter, the Sox told him, hey, start doing this. We can assume he started doing it because the numbers started getting better and reflected what they asked him to do. His fly ball rate jumped up to 44% in the month of July, once again, courtesy of Fangraphs, his highest of any month this season as well. And he's continued the success into August so far. So he actually pulled and lifted the ball even more during certain months last season. So I think there's actually room for more growth here, right? Like, he's posted even better numbers lifting and pulling in the past. And don't just look at his pulled air percentage on StatCast, because again, a lot of what's factored into that number, a lot of the contributors to that number are from April and May, whereas this change took place in June, July, and now August. So that number is going to look low, but I'm willing to bet it would be higher over the last couple of months. Whether or not, you know, regardless of if you're buying into this situation of the Sox saying, hey, pull the ball in the air more, and then all of a sudden he just turns into this great hitter, you can say that's a lot of phooey, I'm not buying it. It's still clear that he's a different hitter from last year. He's striking out way less. It's at 18.6%. He's posted a significantly higher max EV, career best, than he had before. That's 112.1 miles an hour. His previous high was 108.2. That's a pretty big jump. His average exit velocity is up to 89.9. His previous high was last season at 86.6. That's a big jump. His barrel rate is 11.3%. That's better than Freddie Freeman's and Alex Bregman's. It's only 1/10 of a mile an hour lower than Kyle Tucker's. And like, that might seem like useless anecdotes and like I'm handpicking stats to make a point, which is exactly what I'm doing. But his impact on the ball has changed drastically this season. It just has. He's off to a decent start in August. He's hitting .316 so far with a 15% K rate. However, he's yet to homer, still hitting in the bottom half of the order. Like Kevin Williams, the last month and a half or so, that's going to determine a lot here for Rafael. He's got a real chance to finish with like 20 homers, 25 stolen bases, and a decent average. You know, if he hits .260, that's better than league average. That's maybe not that great for fantasy, but like, it's not killing you as you might have expected Seidon Rafaela would earlier in the season. If he does do those things, let's say he goes 20, 25, he gets the decent average, he's probably going to be worth keeping. I mean, he's probably going to go pretty high in drafts, especially with his second base and outfield eligibility. With that said, if the power begins to peter off, the plate discipline continues to be atrocious, if he, you know, takes his foot off the gas pedal at all, because I don't think there's a big margin for error here when you whiff that much and you don't walk enough. Like, the margin for error is slim. He might end up being a cut if that happens. But like Gavin Williams, you know, Rafael is a player who I think you should keep a very close eye on down the stretch over these last 8 or so weeks. All right, so we got time for at least one more here before we call it quits, and I'll go over some honorable mention after that. The last guy I want to talk about is someone who used to go in the first round of drafts for a period of time, and that's Bo Bichette, who is once again enjoying a pretty good season after having a down year last year. So this one might be a little weak because, like, Bo Bichette is basically doing exactly what he's done his, like, entire career. His WRC plus by year, 2019, it was just 212 plate appearances, WRC plus 143. In 2020, the shortened season, WRC plus 120. 2021, his WRC plus was 122. In 2022, his WRC plus was 129. In 2023, his WRC plus was 124. And then out of nowhere, last year, the WRC plus was 70. This year, 125. So, like, he is pretty consistently 25% better than league average, is Bo Bichette. And although he hasn't, I mean, he really hasn't flashed the speed he did back in 2021 when he stole 25 bags. He's only 22nd percentile in sprint speed. It does feel a little bit like intent. Like, he stole 3 bags in April, and it looked like, all right, well, he's looking at another, you know, 18 to 22 stolen base season. And then he just basically stopped running. He did get caught twice that month, so maybe the Blue Jays just kind of put the brakes on him. I don't know, but he's not a speed guy anymore. He's a terrific hitter, though. Steamer projects him for 6 more homers, 25 more runs, 23 more RBI, and 2 more steals the rest of the way. That would put, if he meets those projections, which might be a little conservative, that would put his stat line for 5x5 at 84 runs, 22 homers, 101 RBI, 6 stolen bases, and about a 295 average. I mean, that is like vintage Bo Bichette. Like, you're getting more RBI than runs. He's since switched to the cleanup spot, which I'll talk about, but, like, he is still elite, I guess. I mean, it's weird, a shortstop without speed, but, I mean, he's doing it, man. He has more runs plus RBI right now. He's at 137 than all shortstops, except Ellie De La Cruz and Francisco Lindor. Those are the only two shortstops ahead of Bo Bichette in runs plus RBI. He's tied with only Geraldo Perdomo in that stat as well. So, I mean, I guess it's the four of them there. But he's at a significantly higher batting average than all those players. Like, he's up around 300. All those guys are 260 and below. He leads all shortstop in RBI, which is surprising because he has spent most of the year in the leadoff spot. It wasn't until, like, early July where he started batting cleanup. But he is raking in the RBI in that crazy Blue Jays lineup that's just going off lately. I still think he's going to, you know, produce an elite run plus RBI total, regardless of whether or not he's in the leadoff spot or cleanup spot. If next season they put him back at leadoff, I don't know, maybe he steals bases again, but more likely the RBI number and the run number will just switch. But there's no reason to think he's, like, going to cool off. This is who he's been for his entire career. With an ADP of 118 on NFBC, I think this probably makes Bo Bichette a decent keeper, right? Assuming you'll be all right without a lot of speed from your shortstop. With that said, I really want to see Bichette actually hit those projected numbers and see where everything lands before I commit to that. He has been somebody who's been really streaky, and we can't just ignore that last year happened, right? Like, I'm kind of doing that with this assessment, but he does have a long track record now of being a really, really good hitter. So it does kind of feel like last year was, I don't know, not indicative of who he is. Regardless, it would be nice to see him finish the year out with coming close to those projected numbers. It's easy to forget. I mean, this is a guy who I said sort of at the top of this that was a first-round pick in drafts, and he still doesn't turn 28 years old until next March. And, man, the Blue Jays are so good. He's right in the middle of all of it, consistently a good hitter. I think he could be worth that keeper cost and maybe actually be pretty valuable at such a cost. So Gavin Williams, Sedan Rafaela, and Bo Bichette are three names I'm watching down the stretch here. Here are some honorable mentions that I didn't get to. Two of them are, like, really obvious. I think everybody is keeping an eye on the production of these two players down the stretch here, and that's Luis Robert and Mackenzie Gore. They're kind of like opposite stories. Gore looked like he was breaking out, having a tremendous season. He has been atrocious, really, since the All-Star break. I mean, he's been brutal. You know, multiple earned run starts, 6 earned run starts. So for a guy who, for the first half of the year, was like a top 10, top 20 starter, I want to see how he finishes the year. Because if you'll remember, his last 6 or 7 starts last year, he was fantastic. So if he can repeat that, I think folks will have a lot more confidence drafting him and keeping him going into 2026. Luis Robert, man, so frustrating. I guess he's kind of breathing a sigh of relief that he wasn't traded, because ever since the trade deadline, he has just become the guy who everybody like drafted him to be. It's too late. His counting numbers and sort of everything across the board, I doubt he can salvage his batting average that much. Everything's going to look bad at the end of the year. But you'll want to remember in drafts next year, when you have to make your keeper decisions, how did Luis Robert finish the year? Because right now he's on fire. The power's back. He's never stopped running. He's been running all year. He's looking at a career high in stolen bases. But the hitting and the pop, that's beginning to flash. And if he just keeps this going through the end of the season, I'd revisit, you know, especially if I picked him up off free agency back when he was hitting like 190, if he finally got dropped. Is he a player worth keeping? Because he might be. Two other honorable mentions here. Roki Sasaki, just don't forget about him. The stuff obviously doesn't look as good as we thought it was going to be. He obviously massively disappointed in terms of the stuff, not just the production, but the stuff. However, the splitter really is that good. And we've seen pitchers dominate with a great splitter before, though 110 stuff plus grade on a splitter would rank second in all of baseball behind only Jose Soriano's splitter, which is at a 114. And he's still just 23 years old. He'd have to really show out whenever and if he returns. Apparently the Dodgers expect him back in August. I don't know if that means he'll be making starts for them or if he'll be coming out of the bullpen at that point. I really don't know what the plan is for Roki Sasaki rest of season. And he's really only going to be interesting for this conversation if he was dropped and you added him. If you added him off of free agency in your leagues, like most keeper leagues, are that he's essentially free to keep. He's a last round pick. I'd take a long look at him. Like in the keeper cut listener league number two, I added him off free agency. He would be a last round pick for me to keep. And if he comes back and his splitter looks great and maybe his stuff starts to look a little bit more promising and he's feeling healthy, yeah, I'd consider keeping him. Why not? And then the other one is Edward Cabrera. He didn't qualify because his ADP essentially means he's free everywhere. And I talked about that at the top. But this is why you don't give up on so much talent. I mean, like, look, I'm not saying if you dropped him in your dynasty leagues or whatever that, like, you were wrong to do so. He was horrible. And he wasn't really showing a lot of strides in the direction of fixing the problem, which was walks. However, his stuff was nasty, man, and I just don't want to bet against that. He had to figure out the walks. He was 25 years old going into this season, and look what happened. He did. So I don't want to write guys off too early in their career. Because he was going so late in drafts, it's hard to say that anybody was like really in on Edward Cabrera. But don't write guys off too quickly. He has so far figured them out, and if he finishes the season the way that he's pitching right now, he's got Atlanta tonight. That's a weak line. There's some names in there, but it's been a weak lineup this season. I think Edward Cabrera could really finish the season strong. And if he does, and it looks like the walks are really gone, I mean, are we talking about a top 30 starter? I don't know. Just don't give up on young talent too soon. Give them time to iron things out. Because it looks like Edward Cabrera is a pretty good example of one that has. So, folks, that'll do it. If you stuck with this throughout, like, good for you, man. thank you for listening. Hopefully, you know, next week we get Chad back and we can put out a better, more conversational episode than what you got this time. But thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.